This is the Reaction Podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, introducing the best of the conversations from the Reaction editors and guests in the last week. Most of our discussions on politics, economics and culture are now also available to watch on our YouTube channel. This week, editor Ian Martin spoke to Lord Forsyth about the assisted dying bill, which has reached its second reading in the House of Lords. Here is the full conversation.
Lord Forsyth, Michael Forsyth, you have changed your mind on this subject. Why?
Well, it's partly because I've always been voting against it, and I've always felt rather guilty that I was voting against it, but would quite like to have it for myself. So I felt a bit of a hypocrite about this. And I was influenced, really, I suppose, with the arguments about how it might be abused. When my father was dying and in a lot of pain, and I went to see him just before he died, I said to him, "I'm so sorry that you're suffering so much." And rather to my astonishment, he said, "Well, you're to blame, Michael." And I said, "How am I to blame?" And he said, "Because you and others have consistently voted against the right to die. And, you know, for all the treatments that are available, I am in great pain and I can't actually exit this life as I would like to." And that had quite a powerful effect upon me. And looking at this legislation that's now before the House, which is private members' legislation, Baron Smeacher, I mean, it seems to me that the protections are there. I mean, two GPs plus a High Court judge, an interview to establish what the motives are. These are protections. And I'm quite dismayed by the way people are using arguments against this bill, which have got nothing to do with the content of the bill, but to do with other issues.
So the critics of the bill, opponents of this measure, say their concern is that, I've heard a lot down the years, the phrase that it introduces a culture of death, that it puts some sort of obligation or feeling or weight of obligation on those who are near death, or even those who are elderly or disabled, that somehow they feel that their life is devalued, that people are wanting them in some way to shorten it because they're a burden. As you said, that is an argument that you, or an argument similar to that you previously found powerful.
Well, there are two parts to that argument. One is this bill is about people who are terminally ill and are likely to die within 6 months. So the notion that, you know, abuse can take place and that you'll be forced to sort of go because they're after the money or for whatever reason, I don't think that really applies given what this bill actually says. And then the second point is we know that the status quo is extremely cruel because people resort to taking their own lives in ways which are pretty unpleasant. So it's not as if we're in a perfect situation. And then, of course, you know, if it happened to me, I mean, if I say I got motor neuron disease, I would not want to hang on until I was eventually suffocated and fully conscious of all the bits that were being shut down. I wouldn't want to do that. And in the current position, I go off to Switzerland. I can afford to do that. And people who can afford to do that can do that. But it's a pretty nasty thing to put your family through, to drag them all the way out there and only some of them allowed to be present and then come back in a box. I mean, I believe that people, if at all possible, should be able to die in their own homes. It's one of the reasons I've been such a strong supporter of Marie Curie cancer care. I also believe, of course, that we should have proper palliative care and proper hospices and things of that kind. And I've raised a lot of money for both these causes. And I remember Martin Lewis, the broadcaster, a former broadcaster, coming to see me, wrote a book about hospices and persuaded me when I was a health minister to introduce pound-for-pound funding for hospices. So it's not a choice between palliative care. It's about actually giving people the dignity and the ability to choose how they want to die.
What's the evidence from elsewhere in the world where something similar has been attempted?
Well, there are about 200 million people around the world who do have a right to die living in countries. There is the suggestion that, oh, well, this is the thin end of the wedge. You agreed this bill and it will be extended. The evidence is not that it's been extended. And of course, there are different systems. And Baroness Meacher's bill actually involves a High Court judge. Now, when the opponents of the bill are saying no one's asked the judges, well, the judges are asked when the medics want to withdraw medical support.
Yeah, understood. And explain to us, to to listeners and viewers how this bill works. I mean, what happens from here? We're talking on the day when there's discussion and debate in the Lords. It's a private member's bill. So what are the chances of this becoming law? It certainly seems to be the case that pressure is building, but is that going to manifest itself realistically, do you think, in a change in the law anytime soon?
Well, I don't know what's going to happen, but I think it's something of a farce, actually, because there are almost 200 people speaking and you're given 3 minutes to speak, which is just not enough time to deal with something as complex as this. It really isn't. The opponents of the bill are talking about voting against it on second reading. We never, never vote against bills in the House on second reading. Second reading is about the general principle. And if there are worries about the degree of protection and so on, that is something you deal at committee stage. So if they do vote against the bill and do vote it down, then that will flush out the fact that basically they're against the principle altogether. And all these arguments that are being put are really smokescreen for a view, which is that people don't have the right to decide how they die.
And where is the government on all of this?
I don't know. I read in the Telegraph that Boris Johnson had changed his mind. I don't know whether that is true or not, changed his mind to be against it. This sort of thing, I think, the government ought to provide government time for it to be discussed. It's private legislation, that's true, but it's very difficult to take a private bill through the House of Lords and then into the House of Commons where it can be objected by people who are in the minority. And looking at the speakers list, the last time I looked, I think the majority of people speaking are actually in favour of the bill.
Do you think that this is running with the grain of history? I mean, if you look at public opinion, do you think that things are shifting?
I do, and I think there's a lot of nonsense being talked. I mean, Tanya Gray Thompson, whom I have the most enormous respect for, Olympic medalist, great campaigner for disability. I mean, she has been trying to make out that this is some kind of threat to disabled people. It's not about that at all. It's about people who are wanting to die. It's got nothing whatever to do with disability or respect for the disabled in any way.
The news cycle this week has been dominated by discussions of rising COVID cases and the possibility of a Plan B winter. But what does this all mean? Ian Martin was joined by Alistair Benn to discuss. Here is a snippet from the conversation.
Alistair, where do you think we are after yesterday's performance by the Health Secretary?
Well, we're embracing Plan A for the moment and not going for Plan B, which is, I'll let you come on to that in a moment, Ian, but it reminds me of Dominic Cummings, actually, his narrative about in March and April last year, the government pitching to Plan B, which he had worked up with sort of clever data scientists and, with input from mathematicians like Timothy Gowers, even though half of Europe had gone into a lockdown a week earlier. Don't think it was Dominic Cummings' idea. But anyway, please, can you take me through what the government's reasoning? Why are they sticking to Plan A if they've got this wonderful Plan B? What's the reasoning?
So we should explain the difference, shouldn't we, between Plan A and Plan B?
Yeah.
So Plan A is kind of now, which is a back to normal with some vigilance approach. And then Plan B, if it's required at some point and if the numbers get considerably worse and they fear that the health system is going to be overwhelmed, then they'll move to further restrictions. There's a lot of hype at the moment about will Britain go back to lockdown. It doesn't seem to be that. I think it would have to be something fairly catastrophic to get to that point, but it's more like restrictions on gatherings, compulsory mask wearing in certain settings. But at the moment they're trying to restrict it to advising people to behave sensibly as possible. Look, I mean, this is the government that went for Freedom Day and wanted to make a big play of getting as back to normal as possible to try and undo some of the economic damage. And also, I think, just born of a belief that the health secretary has and the prime minister shares, that while the measures last year and early this year may well have been absolutely necessary in terms of combating COVID. At some point, you have to learn to live with it, that fabled phrase. So I think that's where they are. I would criticize them in one respect. I mean, I think what they're doing is to their credit. I know there are lots of people on Twitter shouting that it's a disaster and you have to move as quickly as possible to some aggressive measures, which I think just discounts the fact that things are very different from 18 months ago or even this time last year. This time last year, we knew that a vaccine was coming, but it wasn't coming for 4 or 5 months. I mean, so we're living in it. We are living with the vaccines, which bring with it an entirely different set of philosophical assumptions about how we should handle it. So I think that's to their credit. Where I would question the way in which things are going, I would question them on boosters and the public information side of things, which had been, I think, very strong in the previous vaccine rollout. They seem to be lagging a bit on getting boosters out, and it's not going quite as fast as they would have thought. I think there is some public confusion about how do you get your booster? Do you wait to be called? Who's handling it? It's not GPs. It seems to be being done centrally. It seems to be being conducted almost, when you talk to people who are waiting for it, by WhatsApp group with people sharing information, rather than there being a strong message about when you can expect to get it and in what order. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's absolutely fair. I think where I would take you up on is the kind of differences in the situation. And I don't think it's just the vaccines that are the difference. I think we are living in a world where social distancing or non-pharmaceutical interventions, as they're often labeled. We're living in a world now where their record is being tested in real time with real sort of country by country comparisons. And I think the record is profoundly mixed in terms of what social distancing is achieving in heavily vaccinated populations in Europe. I mean, take Scotland, for example, which has retained many of the kind of basic measures that the kind of public health kind of voices often advocate for. And its experience of COVID in the last few months has been broadly similar to England, because there are other factors, deprivation in Scotland's old industrial west, you know, all other factors which have contributed to inability to work from home, all that stuff. In Europe, yes, some countries have much lower COVID rates than us, France or Germany, but there are plenty which have, you know, in the Baltic states and in Eastern Europe, which are not, you know, which are sort of portrayed sometimes in the media as if they're kind of sinkholes with, you know, where, you know, these things are just impossible. But you know, these places have massive non-pharmaceutical interventions, vaccine passport systems, compulsory masking, and, you know, are experiencing quite high rates of COVID comparable to over here. So I think that it adds to the kind of inherent complexity of the debate over social distancing as we're having it at the moment. People are sort of being able to read the runes for themselves and manage their own risk like that, I think. And that adds something to the picture.
What do you make of the numbers? Because, I mean, look, we've been through the crisis together, talking and writing about this. Actually, it's interesting. We've been on these reaction YouTube videos and podcasts. We've been talking primarily about other things for months, haven't we, really? There's been so much else going on. And I wonder if that's a bit of a factor with the government as well, actually, in the UK, just that if you look at the news agenda since the summer, I mean, it's really dominated by Afghanistan reshuffle, build up to COP26. The biggest story of the lot has been concerns about supply chains and energy. So I'm not excusing them. I'm simply explaining that a lot else has been happening. But so we covered the crisis together and talked about it a lot. and were concerned a lot about the coverage. Now, there's all sorts of screaming out there about the numbers on Twitter. How are we to read, do you think, the fact that Britain seems to have pretty high numbers relative to, I know you mentioned some other countries where that's not the case, but relative to similar sized countries in Europe, Britain's got a lot of COVID.
Yeah, and you look at the numbers ever since sort of the Delta variant arrived here and sort of gained traction. You know, we did have a very fast sort of exponential increase in numbers in July, to some extent, I think, inflected by the fact we had a massive football tournament here with huge social gatherings, encouraged by the PM and everyone. You know, we had made a trade-off, right? People wanted to watch the football, but a lot of people got COVID, and most people were ready to make that trade-off. Since then, it's gone up and down at quite high levels. You look at the numbers at the moment, and the rate of increase has slowed and is potentially sort of, it's still increasing, but not as much. And the rate of increase might just be about to turn again. Don't know if that will happen, but it's not a frightening increase, like we saw in July, where it was going up very, very fast. And I would very much agree with actually, some of the voices from Sage at the moment who are warning, look at the actual situation. We're doing a huge amount more of testing in schools. A lot of these people haven't been vaccinated. That wave was always going to happen when schools came back, basically effectively back to normal. That will probably peter out in a few weeks. And we've got to, I think throughout the whole crisis, I think everyone's got a lot wrong, but I think we've been good on the podcast about trying to talk about what the real issue is at stake. Like what's actually going on here? What will make a difference to the problem? Now, the calls to, for example, introduce mask mandates on public transport do not make a difference to the problem we are talking about. They might make a sort of amorphous difference or make people feel better, but the marginal crucial difference is not going to be made by enforcing working age adults to meet outside sometimes. It's the problem, if there is a problem, is schools being back to normal and a lot of teenagers getting COVID. Hopefully that will stabilize. But that brings us into a more fundamental argument, which I think the government is right to sort of stay clear of, but I think is the fundamental one, is over the next few months, are working age adults going to modify their behavior on the basis that a booster campaign doesn't deliver, or that cases are rising in elderly people don't come forward for their boosters? If that is the trade-off we are all willing to make, i.e. not changing our behavior as working age adults, then we're going to have to accept a degree of mortality in the general population, which we need to argue about. That for me is the trade-off. Do we want to continue in this return to normal where we're slowly getting, we have things like gatherings or be able to play sport or all that? Or do we want to go back to social distancing? And this is as working age people, because
hold on there. I understand the distinction, and I can see why should people, I'm in the camp that would say that people should try and be as sensible as possible and exit, just through the exercise of free will, try and avoid reckless behavior. I understand that, though. I can see philosophically why some people want reckless behavior back. Actually, it's part of life. But why should people alter their behavior because X number of people in the population, I think 5 million people over 16, won't have the vaccine at all, and then some people are also vaccine hesitant on the boosters? There's a question there about, we don't know yet how serious that problem is, because there is the problem with the rollout is slow.
And now, press review. Ian Martin was joined by Maggie Bugano and Mark Fox to discuss stories ranging from Poland's relationship to the EU to the foibles of royal correspondence.
Mark, I think you had the first story, a pick from the Financial Times.
Well, Chris Giles has interviewed Hugh Pill, the new chief economist at the Bank of England. And it's a big interview, really good interview. But in it, he seems to me to be flagging quite a dramatic departure from what the bank and others have been saying, where he warns about inflation hitting 5%, if not more. And this is one of those stories, isn't it, Ian and Maggie, that we sort of all think we know because we sense it in our weekly shop. And if anybody's gone to the petrol pump, which I did earlier, right, which was enough of a shock, had to have a lie down and take oxygen afterwards. We all sort of know prices are going up and think, but the sort of the bank and our politicians have been sort of playing it down and saying it's temporary, it's all a bit of a blip.
Yeah.
But Hugh Pill is very clearly preparing the country for a pretty substantial and longer lasting increase in inflation than we have been used to having in recent time.
Yeah, it's a really good pick, and it is a good interview by Chris Giles. But there's something very interesting has happened in the markets this week, where they are, because of course the implication that inflation is not as transient as it seemed and is going to be longer lasting then has knock on implications for the bank's policy on interest rates. So essentially, what people want to know is, are interest rates about to rise? And yes, they are. They're about to start nudging upwards. But if you look at the way that the short and long markets, the sort of the bets that traders and investors are making or have made this week, they seem to anticipate a short-term spike in interest rates, sort of slightly higher than people anticipated, but then longer-term falling away. So it's difficult to work out. It may be, as someone who works in that world said to me, it may be that those in the markets are calculating that the bank will have to sort of overreact, and then there'll be some sort of further economic shock, which will mean they'll have to go to looser policy, later next year or the year after. How do you read it, Maggie?
Confused. I think, and I'm wondering whether actually that's not what they're aiming to do. Until the last few weeks, the idea was we wouldn't have interest rate rises until at least next spring. It was definitely 2022. And then Andrew Bailey a couple of weeks ago hinted, didn't he, when he spoke to central governors, that it might be sooner than later. And of course, the MPC meets on November the 4th. And from what I can gather, it's quite divided. There are at least two members who've said that putting up interest rates now would be damaging to the economy, just as we're moving out of and into recovery stage. Some people are even saying it would tip us into recession. Others want to see a short, sharp jolt, as you're just saying, to try and halt inflation. I'm not sure it would make any difference at all. And so I'm sort of wondering, the markets are anticipating it, and maybe that's what they wanted them to do, so that the markets are doing some of the work for them. There is another view, and I'm so sorry because I can't remember where I read it, but a very good analysis, and everyone's been saying, the US and in Britain, saying this is temporary, transitory. Well, if you look at what's happened in the supply chains, it's been because of a rise in, it's the disruption in supply chains leading to energy rises and so forth. It's been because of an excess demand. The demand has put pressure on, whether it's in China, output and so forth, not as a consequence of things going wrong. So the temporary argument is, so once they meet that demand, then actually we'll start to see it even out. I don't know whether that is the correct analysis, but it's certainly something to take on board.
But Ian, I think that Maggie's dog is really that reflecting, right, my sense of this. You and Maggie, of course, are great city watchers and gurus and viewers. Ian's written a couple of very good books, and if you haven't bought them, please do, because he needs the money, right? But the fact is that city watching is about par, isn't it, with going down to the casino with a bunch of £10 notes and putting it on red and hoping that it comes up.
Yeah.
But the really interesting thing about this, for me, is the political implications, right? Because for a prime minister who defies political gravity on a sustained basis so far, it's amazing. Yeah. But we have not had tested in recent decades a prime minister and a government who has had to face real increases in real costs in people's weekly shop and their everyday living, and how resilient and how immune to feeling fed up with that the electorate will be. So for me, it's a very frontline issue. That's a good point.
I think it. Yes, it's a real test. But I do think after the events of the last couple of years, it's fascinating to see people who would usually be making very strong declarations about what's about to happen in the economy. It's obviously there's enormous inflation coming. It's it's because of central bank policy. People are, as you said, Maggie, confused and watching and waiting to see. I mean, Chris Giles, who wrote that piece in the FT and interviewed Hugh Pill, that's a good get. And we're going to be hearing a lot more from Hugh Pill in the next couple of years. Of course, he's taken over from Andy Haldane at the Bank of England. So he's going to become a big figure and public's going to see a lot more of him. Also, I always think, Chris Giles is a writer, although I don't always agree with him or don't always agree with his with the policy positions that he takes. He is very skilled. I always think back to the groundbreaking profile he did of Mervyn King, which infuriated Mervyn King's allies. But so that was Chris Giles in the FT. Maggie, you've got a selection of things which illustrate one story, which is this amazing story in relating to Poland and the EU.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I've sort of gone for a triple decker here because it gives a sense of the timeline of what's happened this week. So the first explanatory piece is from Politico, from two great journalists, Suzanne Lynch and Jakub Hanka-Vella, hope I got his name pronounced correctly, who set out on Tuesday what the debate was about. And then my second piece is from Facts for EU, or Facts for You, which gives the transcript of Ursula von der Leyen and the Polish Prime Minister it actually clashing in Brussels earlier this week. And then today's piece from Joe Barnes, Brussels correspondent from The Telegraph, who is giving the response when Angela Merkel yesterday is trying to quell this debate. So very briefly, what has happened is, as most people will know, the Polish High Court ruled that laws made in Poland are sovereign and over and above primacy beyond the EU. This, as you can imagine, went down like a ton of bricks with our friends in Brussels. And as we know, there have been disputes between the two over the years. But what was so different this time was the way the president of the commission, Ursula von der Leyen, hit back at the Polish prime minister and threatened punitive action, i.e. withholding some of the money going from the recovery fund and so forth. And what the Facts for You piece does is it gives the transcripts of both their speeches, which haven't been translated elsewhere into English yet, and they really make for quite damning reading. So this is not, I think, people talking about Polexit far too soon. I don't think, most of the Polish people don't want it. I don't think that's the interesting point about the story. The interesting point is, who is it, nation states or the legal foundation of the EU that has primacy?
That was noteworthy in terms of Angela Merkel's remarks, where she speculated on this. This is a bit late in the day, post-Brexit, and after everything that's happened in the EU and during her tenure, to say, well, this is the great discussion. Is it more nation states or is it ever closer union? I could imagine David Cameron's face when he's sort of having this great dawning realization.
Maybe she learned a little bit from Brexit.
Partly, but as the Germans like to say, not everything is about Brexit or the Brits here. But there does seem to be something fundamental going on in the European Union, and I think it's partly because it is Poland. Because Poland, remember, of course, Britain was a country that was very much an advocate of expansion, of the EU enlargement, and the idea was that enlargement was going to dilute the EU or dilute the demand for ever closer union. And it's very important to the EU that Poland stays in, and it's always been caught between historically between Germany and Russia, and for obvious reasons, you know, chooses the West and wants to align with the West, but then now finds its, or its government finds in large parts of its population, a lot of the European ideal, while it likes being in the EU and likes the sort of protection of the West, there's a lot of discomfort with the positions that the EU is taking. Also, there, I mean, some of the polls, opinion polls, that is, have shifted a little bit. I mean, there's still overwhelming support for staying in. So I'm not predicting poll exit, as you put it, Maggie, but something is stirring.
On that point, sorry, just very quickly, I mean, that's exactly it. They're very unhappy with the way Germany has cozied up to Russia on Nord Stream and so forth. And actually, a large part of the Prime Minister's speech was about the energy crisis, you know, which they can't control, and about environmental laws, because it will damage their economy just so badly.
And it was an electric moment in the chamber, which doesn't happen very often in the European Parliament. But when the Polish Premier read out a list of statements defending constitutional integrity and sovereignty, and he even said, "Look, I can see by your faces that you're not particularly enjoying hearing this." But he played a very clever trick, which is that the statements that he read out were statements said by the Spanish, yes, and by, I think, by the Italians and by various other
Germans
governments, emphasizing that point. So he played a very clever rhetorical trick. Mark, you were going to say.
Well, I'm bursting to say, because, of course, I'm in the presence of two mighty Brexiteers. And, of course, we spent a long time talking about an organisation, a faraway organisation about which we know increasingly little. But it comes in the week, doesn't it, where it looks as though the Prime Minister is going to agree a certain degree of European court sovereignty and jurisdiction over Northern Ireland, although it will be dressed up with an arbitration panel and a sort of all of that. The result, fact is that at the end of the day, if the reports are true, it looks as though Boris Johnson is going to agree with the European Union that the European Court has a role to play on Northern Ireland issues, where it will have supremacy over domestic UK courts.
Well, we'll see. And of course,
I thought that would send your
the position you've just mapped out there in rather hysterical,
apocalyptic,
rather hysterical terms, Mark, is that. Is the position that the UK government signed up to when it when it signed the protocol and the Brexit deal? But the reality is that, as various people have made clear, the British were signing up to it, and Brexiteers were voting for it just to try and end the farce, and then hope to sort some of it out later. I mean, we'll see on that. Actually, I mean, I suspect those reports are correct, and there'll be some form of compromise patched together. I don't think a trade war suits anyone, but we'll find out soon enough. My next
moving pick, swiftly on.
My
can I very quickly, for the record and on the
have
record,
I introduced you, Maggie? I'm sorry, I've introduced
you. No, you haven't introduced me, but you misinformed. I voted for Remain.
You'll be getting your P45 from the editor.
No, I think Ian knows this. But once the vote, but I was on the fence. I could have gone either way easily. But what we should have done, of course, is stayed in the EEA, and we wouldn't have any of these problems with Northern Ireland. We
could we've lost about 5,000 subscribers. Right,
we're moving into a sort of generalised Brexit discussion. No one wants to rerun the referendum and all of that nastiness. And this is Press Review, where we don't just have generalised political discussions. We flag up the stories and writers, podcasts as well, and broadcasts that have grabbed us in the last week or so from around the world. So it's not just the UK. My next pick is actually, I mean, closer to home, but it is a global story, is from Reaction, which is Tim Marshall, our columnist, best-selling author, Power of Geography, Prisoners of Geography, amazing author, writes every Friday for Reaction on geopolitics for Reaction members. And his most recent column, it's in response to a story which broke last weekend is about the fabled hypersonic missile that the Chinese allegedly fired, which of course they say was really just a conventional spacecraft or space vehicle of some sort, but which does seem to have spooked the Pentagon and others. And it's a typically terrific column from Tim, but it makes a very, and we will come on to some good news in a moment, but it makes a rather scary point about the nuclear deterrent and the defense doctrine, which hadn't really occurred to me before. And as Tim says in the piece, that in the old world of nuclear weapons, of sort of relatively slow moving weaponry, there was at least some time of slack in the system for powers to warn each other or to diffuse a situation. So you think, and he mentions Dr. Strangelove, there is time, even if it doesn't work, spoiler alert, for the president of the United States and the Russian leadership to have a telephone conversation. And there are examples from the last 40, 50 years where leaders can communicate and diffuse a situation. If we're moving to hypersonic missiles and some doubt about whether they would have nuclear capacity or conventional capacity, you create another potential for misunderstanding, but things happening, and the world is moving ever faster, it seems, with technology, things going wrong at high speed. I don't know what to say beyond that, other than what a cheering thought that is. But it's a terrific piece by Tim. Mark, do you want to come in on that from the defence point of view?
Well, I just think that it is a superb piece, and Tim's just fantastic, as we know. But I think it just brings into sharp relief the sort of the increasing polarization and sort of divide that is growing between Russia, China, and large elements of the West. You know, we had a couple of weeks ago the AUKUS thing signed, which was led by the navies of Australia and Britain, followed by the politicians with America involved, which was really important, although it's annoyed the French polity, massively. I mean, the French politicians are so cross. But you can see why Washington and London wanted to do it and why it has traction. And also the threat from Russia is increasing. You know, we know about Russia is a real global leader in underwater submarine technology and activity. Right, we tend to look at its old aircraft carrier and laugh as it chugs its way around, belching smoke, and it can't get planes on it. But the fact is that under the water, they're absolutely state of the art. And we are racing. And China, I think I read this week in one of the papers that China was producing ships that accounted for the size of, what was it, France, Britain, and Australia every 5 months or something, the size of their combined navies. Yeah. I mean, it's massive. Absolutely massive. So Tim's thing is part of a piece as technology rapidly moves ahead into these new areas. And I think it's come up on us slightly because we haven't been concentrating, generally speaking, because of the pandemic and for us, Brexit and lots of other things. But this international sparring and tension is certainly increasing again.
Yep. So, Mark, I'm going to come back to you in 1 second for some good news. But if you're not a subscriber to Reaction on YouTube, you're watching Press Review, hit the subscribe button below and also like this video, if indeed you do like this video. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, our main site, and you want Tim Marshall's column, Maggie Pagano's brilliant column on business and other things, and my weekly newsletter on politics and all the other work that the team does, you go to the site, the address is below, and you can become an annual member. There's an offer on at the moment. Mark, some good news, cheer us up, about the Queen.
Well, I'm just going to introduce this around the Queen by saying, of course, this week we have been celebrating Trafalgar Day. And we all know, Ian won't because he's Scottish, but Maggie will know, this is the greatest Englishman of all time, Nelson. Absolutely. Whose great trick was, of course, always, wasn't it, to sail through the enemy's line. And that actually gave me pause to think about Two stories, actually, I was going to say, one very happy and one sad. One is very happy because it's the news that the Queen, although she had such a busy week this week, has had to cancel her trip to celebrate the centenary of Northern Ireland, and that it turns out that she spent a night in hospital, but it seems to be that she's back at her desk, as Windsor Castle is very keen to point out that.
Yeah. Can I just interrupt you there, Mark, just on one point on that related to that story, because this has caused a bit of a media storm, hasn't it? Well, firstly, as you say, it's good news. She's 95 and she's back home and apparently in good spirits. The story in the Times by Valentine Lowe this afternoon, which is Palace condemned for keeping Queen's hospital stay secret. And this is the BBC's royal correspondent, Nicholas Witchell, being furious, it seems, and questioning how much the palace could be trusted because this was kept secret and then only revealed by the Sun. How do you feel about that, Mark?
Okay.
Do we have a right to know? I mean, she's our head of state.
So you know that old saying they used to say, the head butler at Buckingham Palace is always grander than the monarch, right? Royal correspondents tend to be the grandest of grand correspondents, right? It's a bit like meeting the imperial household if you meet any royal correspondent, which, of course, the great Nicholas Witchell, and indeed the sainted Robert Hardman, who was on the Today programme this morning.
I was just going to exclude Robert Hardman from your evisceration, actually.
Look, I teased him because I used to make a good living out of writing royal stories myself when I was a practicing journalist, so I do not poo-poo the thing. But the truth is that we're dealing here with a very remarkable 95-year-old person who has had an extremely busy week by any standards. I think she's the head of state, the monarch. The idea that she can go for a private visit anywhere outside of her own private apartments in her homes is absurd. And I think, Ian, all this is all a bit artificial, right? The palace is doing what the palace always does. The palace knows that if the Queen goes to hospital and stays the night, and they say it was unexpected, but surprise, surprise, somebody managed to rustle up a toothbrush and a nightdress and all the kit and caboodle, you know, the phone and all this, right? So take it with a pinch of salt. You will never know for years to come the truth of it. But the truth is the palace knows that everybody will get to know about it. Probably other royal correspondents are as more cross about the fact that the Sun had it, if we're being honest about it, than the Buckingham Palace trying to hide it. But I think all that is complete hoo-ha about nothing. The key thing is she's back at home at Windsor Castle. We hope that she's in robust good health, but it is a reminder to us that she's 95.
It is, but also, Maggie, it is a reminder that she's, I mean, this may be because the monarch is determined to carry on being active and be as engaged as possible, which is obviously a positive thing. But I was very struck this week by, and there were, I think, pictures from the event, that the government, because the government, of course, who are in bad odour with business globally and big business in the UK, were delighted that the Queen and other senior members of the royal family, but particularly the Queen, who's always a great lure for business leaders, turned up for this global investment summit on Tuesday. And she wasn't there for very long for the evening reception. She was in a kind of side room, I understand, so I'm told. And lots of people who thought they were going to meet the Queen didn't get to meet the Queen, so it is said, which strikes me as completely crazy in the context of her being 95 and is going into a COVID, flu and cold winter. And as someone at Westminster pointed out to me, not only is the political class of the government prepared to have the Queen there to aid its green investment plans before COP26, the plan, I think I'm right in saying, is for her to go to COP26 along with 30,000 other people from 200 countries, which strikes me as potentially a great sort of November Petri dish in Glasgow, because the government wants obviously wants the most famous person in the world there. But that, am I being alarmist? It just strikes me as completely daft to expect her to go.
I suspect that she probably won't go after this scare, don't you think?
I hope not.
But in terms of, can I just go back to your very beginning? You said, you know, people feel they should have a right to know. There's absolutely no right to know. And I think the palace were right. Everyone would have gone bonkers. There would have been the whole world's press outside the hospital. What really astonished me about the story is, I mean, what would she go into a hospital for? What sort of tests? So would it be heart monitors, you know, cardiograms or whatever? I'm so surprised that they wouldn't be able to take all that to Buck House or to Windsor Castle to do the tests there. That's actually the bit that surprised me about the story. Yeah. But in terms of wheeling her out, I suspect that she'd be advised not to go to Glasgow.
Wheeling her out, Maggie? Wheeling her out? You're talking about the Queen, Her Majesty.
Maggie, this is you're not in a Fleet Street newsroom.
Sorry,
this is press reviews. Has
a divine right. I thought it's very interesting. She does believe utterly in the divine right of her rule, and she will go on until she literally drops. And that's so admirable, I think.
Yep. Mark, you're going to move on to we're going to move on.
Very firm chair, isn't it, Meg?
Just on the question of, and this is not a much less happy subject than the Queen being hale and hearty, assisted dying, and you wanted to flag up the story about from the BBC about Frank Field.
Well, I did, because the news has come through, reported by the BBC, as you say, Ian, that Frank Field's made a statement that he's in the process of dying. We've known that he's not been well on and off for some time, and we sort of, you know, and he's a good age, but nevertheless, it's terribly sad because he's just immensely distinguished and, you know, effective and charismatic, a Westminster politician who's fought some of Labour's hardest battles through the years of militant and all of that, and fought and kept his seat in Birkenhead, and was just such a champion of the disadvantaged and the vulnerable and the weak, and a really sort of decent sort of a person. And Frank Field, being Frank Field, is not shy about, you know, issuing a statement and explaining what's happening, and so, as we would expect from him, being very courageous. Yeah. But it's a moment to pause. And we all have known him, haven't we, Ian and Maggie? And we know that very rare people of his decency and courage and resilience make it through a whole career in politics.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right, Mark. One of my favourite people at Westminster. You know, it is, as you say, very sad. His statement was read out by Baroness Meacher in the House of Lords during this, I mean, it's a private member's bill, during this debate taking place on Friday on the question of introducing assisted dying. I interviewed Lord Forsyth for Reaction on YouTube on this question, because Michael Forsyth has changed his mind on the subject after effectively his father, who was dying in considerable pain, said, "I blame you." A very, you know, tough thing to hear. But what he meant was he blamed legislators who had for years not done something about this particular question. Maggie, you disagree with the attempt at changing the law?
I do. I don't. It's quite a simple view that I have, which is that we didn't choose when we come into this world, and I don't think it's for us or those around us to choose when we depart. And I don't think it's the role of the state to be part of it. And in many ways, it sort of happens anyway in many situations. And I think that it just opens up so many. It happened. What I mean is, people are assisted. You know, we have nil by mouth. We all know of cases of how it can be taken out. I mean, it's a really touchy, very sensitive, very tricky subject. But my instinct is that we should leave it as it is.
It is very difficult, and I think lots of us have been wrestling with it. I mean, I have to say that my mind has been changing on this for the last couple of years. And I think that Michael Forsyth's comments were, I thought, so coherent and so well delivered that I think that they were, in my case, decisive in changing my mind. Well, I can still see the arguments, and I respect the slippery slope argument, the potential that it could create what some commentators call, you know, a culture of death. But I think what is being talked about here is really specific, and it is pain that can be avoided, and I think the safeguards are perfectly feasible. And I just think that things are shifting in this direction, so that even if the law doesn't change this time, I think that's where things are going. It's also going to be, I mean, we're not talking here about specific pieces here in press review, because there'll be a lot written over the weekend, I think. It's a rare example of Parliament actually leading the way here, and I think there'll be a lot of interesting writing done over the coming days and weeks, which we'll get we'll examining again, and I'm sure we'll discuss this issue in more detail another time. I just want to wrap up with one final piece that I wanted to highlight, which is from the Financial Times again, which we mentioned at the beginning, but this is something completely different, which is a magazine story from Henry Mance, which is Inside John Lewis, and it's just a fabulous piece of reporting and analysis, which grapples with, and I'd love to hear your views about John Lewis, the question of what on earth is to become of this extraordinary brand, such a big part of British life. And he explains through the history, really, why it's become central to the British middle class way of life, and just the terrible forces people from the digital economy will say, these are not terrible forces, these are just market forces, but it's being turned upside down by digital retailing. And there is this question now, just as Henry frames it very well, just in the modern world, in the digital world, do you need John Lewis? I mean, it's a great personal regret to me. It's something I look to as a sort of staple of British life, though feel less and less need to go there. Maggie?
It's a wonderful radio recording that John Spedden Lewis did with the BBC in about 1955. He was in his 80s. And he explained why he, in 1929, I think it was, why they chose, or the father chose, to give him, or give the company to the employees. And he said, it was something to the effect of, we've got to find a middle way. We've got the Bolsheviks in Russia trying to control the economy with the communism. In here in Britain, we've got the sort of managerial capitalists. I think that was the expression. We want to find another way. It was a really wonderful and quite revolutionary form of ownership. And it's sort of paradoxical. It's become this totemic thing of the British middle classes, and, you know, always on the side of the angels. So I think there will always be, hopefully they'll keep that ownership structure, and they'll have to adapt. They'll have to find the middle way again between capitalism. I mean, actually, they're doing very well on online. They're adapting their online very quickly.
Belatedly, so, yeah.
Yeah, belatedly. Well, Andy Street would argue that actually 10 years ago he was setting the pace, but it's a tricky...
Andy Street was now, you know, is now in politics, but was running...
Managing director of John Lewis. Yeah. I suspect they overexpanded a bit with Waitrose and some of the pricing. They got their pricing wrong. But the John Lewis stores, I think there is a role, but it would be a smaller, more contained.
The Reaction editors there with their weekly pick of global stories and great journalism. I'm Francesca Peacock. This is the Reaction podcast. And until next week, thank you for listening.